Chapter 38. The president leaned into Daniel Fawcett's office and waved. "Don't get up. Just wanted you to know I'm going upstairs for a quiet lunch with my wife. Don't forget we have a meeting with the intelligence chiefs and Doug Oates in 45 minutes," Fawcett reminded him. "I promise to be on time." The president turned and took the elevator to his living quarters on the second floor of the White House. Ira Hagen was waiting for him in the Lincoln suite.
"You look tired, Ira."
Hagen smiled.
"I'm behind on my sack time. How do we stand?"
"I've accounted for the identities of all 9 members of the inner core. 7 are pinpointed. Only Leonard Hudson and Gunnar Erickson remain outside the net."
"You haven't picked up their trail from the shopping center?"
Hagen hesitated.
"Nothing that panned out."
"The Soviet moon station was launched 8 hours ago," said the president. "I can't delay any longer. Orders will go out this afternoon to round up as many of the inner core as we can."
"Army or FBI?"
"Neither. An old buddy in the Marine Corps has the honors. I've already supplied him with your list of names and locations." The president paused and stared at Hagen.
"You said you accounted for the identities of all 9 men, Ira, but your report only gave 8 names."
Hagen seemed reluctant, but he reached inside his coat and withdrew a sheet of folded paper.
"I was saving the last man until I could be absolutely certain. A voice analyzer confirmed my suspicions."
The president took the paper from Hagen's hand, unfolded it, and read the single hand-printed name. He removed his glasses and wearily wiped the lenses as if he didn't trust his eyes. Then he slipped the paper into his pocket.
"I suppose I knew all along, but couldn't bring myself to believe his complicity."
"Do not judge harshly, Vince. These men are patriots, not traitors. Their only crime is silence. Take the case of Hudson and Erickson, pretending to be dead all these years. Think of the agony that must have caused their friends and families. The nation can never compensate them for their sacrifices or fully comprehend the rewards of their accomplishment."
"Are you lecturing me, Ira?"
"Yes, sir, I am." The president suddenly became aware of Hagen's inner struggle. He understood that his friend's heart wasn't in the final confrontation. Hagen's loyalty was balanced on a razor's edge.
"You're holding out on me, Ira."
"I won't lie to you, Vince.
You know where Hudson and Erickson are hiding."
"Let's say I have a damned solid hunch."
"Can I trust you to bring them in?"
"Yes."
"You're a good scout, Ira."
"Where do you want them delivered and when?"
"Camp David," the president replied. 8 o'clock tomorrow morning."
"We'll be there."
"I can't include you, Ira."
"The decent thing to do on your part, Vince. Call it a repayment of sorts. You owe it to me to be in on the finish."
The president considered that.
"You're right. It's the very least I can do." Martin Brogan, director of the CIA, Sam Emmett of the FBI, and Secretary of State Douglas Oates came to their feet as the president entered the conference room with Dan Fawcett on his heels.
"Please be seated, gentlemen," the president said, smiling.
There were a few minutes of small talk until Alan Mercier, the National Security Advisor, entered.
"Sorry for being late," he said, quickly sliding into a chair. "I haven't even had time to think of a good excuse."
"An honest man," Brogan said, laughing. "How disgusting."
The president poised a pen above a notepad. "Where do we stand on the Cuban Pact?" he asked, looking at Oates.
"Until we can open a secret dialogue with Castro, it's pretty much on the back burner."
"Is there a remote possibility Jesse LeBaron might have gotten through with our latest reply?"
Brogan shook his head.
"I feel it's very doubtful she made contact. Our sources have had no word since the blimp was shot down. The consensus is she's dead."
"Any word at all from the Castros?"
"None."
"What do you hear from the Kremlin?"
"The internal struggle going on between Castro and Antonov is about to break out in the open," said Mercier. "Our people inside the Cuban War Ministry say that Castro is going to pull his troops out of Afghanistan."
"That clinches it," said Fawcett.
Antonov won't stand idle and allow that to happen. Emmett leaned forward and folded his hands on the table. It all goes back to 4 years ago when Castro begged off making even a token payment on the $10 billion owed to the Soviet Union on loans constantly rolled over since the 1960s. He painted himself into an economic corner and had to knuckle under when Antonov demanded he send troops to fight in Afghanistan. Not simply a few small companies, but nearly 20,000 men. "What estimate does the CIA have of casualties?" asked the president, turning to Brogan. "Our figures show approximately 1,600 dead, 2,000 wounded, and over 500 missing."
"Good Lord, that's better than 20%.
"Another reason the Cuban people detest the Russians," Brogan continued. "Castro is like a drowning man, sinking between a leaking rowboat whose crew is pointing a gun at him and a luxury yacht whose passengers are waving champagne bottles. If we throw him the rope, the crew in the Kremlin will blast him." "Actually, they're planning on blasting him anyway," Emmett added. "Do we have any idea how or when the assassination will take place?" asked the president. Brogan shifted in his chair uneasily. "Our sources have been unable to turn up a timetable." "Their security on the subject is as tight as anything I've ever seen," said Mercier. "Our computers have failed to decode any data from our space listening systems tuned to the operation. Only a few bits and pieces that fail to give us a concrete fix on their plans."
"Do you know who is in charge of it?" the president persisted.
"General Peter Velikov, GRU, considered something of a wizard at Third World government infiltration and manipulation. He was the architect of the Nigerian overthrow 2 years ago. Fortunately, the Marxist government he set up didn't last."
"Is he operating out of Havana?"
"He's secretive as hell," replied Brogan. "The perfect image of the man who isn't there. Velikov hasn't been seen in public in the past 4 years. We're dead certain he's directing the show from a hidden location." The president's eyes seemed to darken. "All we have here is a vague theory that the Kremlin plans to assassinate Fidel and Raul Castro, fix the blame on us, then take over the government using Cuban stooges who receive their orders straight from Moscow. Come now, gentlemen, I can't act on what-ifs. I need facts." "It's a projection based on known facts," Brogan explained heavily. "We have the names of the Cubans who are on the Soviet payroll and waiting on the sidelines to assume power. Our information fully supports the Kremlin's intent to murder the Castros. The CIA makes the perfect scapegoat because the Cuban people have not forgotten the Bay of Pigs or the agency's fumbling plots to assassinate Fidel by the Mafia during the Kennedy administration. I assure you, Mr. President, I have given this every priority. 60 agents on every level in and out of Cuba are concentrating on penetrating Velikov's wall of secrecy. And yet we can't reach Castro for an open dialogue to help each other."
"No, sir," said Oates. "He's resisting any contact through official channels."
"Doesn't he realize his time may be running out?" asked the president.
"He's wandering in a vacuum," Oates replied. "On one hand, he feels secure in knowing the great mass of Cubans idolize him. Few national leaders can command the awe and affection he enjoys from his people. And yet, on the other, he cannot fully comprehend the dead seriousness of the Soviet threat on his life and government."
"So what you're telling me," said the president gravely, "is that unless we can make an intelligence breakthrough or get someone into Castro's hideout who can make him listen to reason, we can only sit back and watch Cuba sink under total Soviet domination."
"Yes, Mr. President," said Brogan, "that is exactly what we're telling you."